I have a number of questions, and then we'll see when this gets boring, maybe after 5 minutes, and then we'll open it up to the rest of you. But I have some serious questions and some not as important questions. So, Alistair, what sports team would the fans in Cleveland most want to see win a championship? What are they most rabid about?
It would have to be the Browns, I would think, wouldn't it?
I think they have the least chance to win one. Yeah.
In the time that I've been there, you know, the Cavs were a great team with Elo and Mark Price and Larry Nance. And,
people thought you were going to LeBron, but you went way back.
Yeah, forget LeBron. No. I've actually lost interest in the NBA almost entirely. I love the college basketball, but I don't really watch that very much. So I don't remember the last time I went. I do remember the last time I went to a Cavs game. It was when we played Orlando, and LeBron hit that amazing shot at the absolute final buzzer to extend the possibility of us going forward. I can't remember what it was. So that was good. But we're always close and no cigar. And then, of course, the same thing we had a tremendous run in the baseball. It went really, really well. And now it's kind of a shadow of what it's been. It's really too bad, actually. As a sports fan, I'd like to have seen us win something. I don't see anything on the horizon, mind you.
So what's your favorite sport?
Of the American sports?
Or any sport? What other sports
football,
they play?
Soccer, football. What the world calls football and what America calls soccer. It's the only game I've ever really played effectively well. And it's the game that I understand the most and enjoy watching the best. I mean, right now my recorder on my TV is working feverishly while I'm here, recording all these games from the English Premier League, and I'll watch them when I get home before I watch Michigan hopefully win tonight. And then golf, of course, is the game that I get to play now, and I've played that since I was a wee boy as well. I'm not any good at it, but I love it with a passion.
Do they give the Scottish children clubs when they're born? Just have to play.
As a boy growing up in Scotland, and you have to really search for them now. There's not many left, but and some of you'll know this from your travels. There were. In small towns in Scotland, there would be putting greens, public putting greens, in the middle of the town, with a little box. If those of you who've gone to St Andrews, the famous one there, of course, is called the Himalayas, and there's a private club there of St Andrews ladies who the tea is closed every so often in the day so that they can play. But it was a tremendous bunch of fun to be able to go up and pay sixpence and get a putter. And I really got into putting, and I still love putting today because I used to be in competition with my father all the time. I took his golf clubs a first time probably without permission, and then I've gone on from there. I started playing with my hands the wrong way on the club because I didn't have a clue what I was doing. And I was at one of those horrible days when I was playing with a boy from school, and he said, "You know you hold the club the wrong way." And I said, "I do not." And he said, "Well, do you see anyone else out here holding the club like that?" And then I looked, I said, "Golly, I do hold it the wrong way, you know." So then I had to get it back. I was holding it in a left-hand grip, but hitting it right-handed. That's hard to do. And it wasn't because of how good I was.
Have you ever played a golfer in a movie?
I played the golf pro in the movie. You know, I played Stuart Maiden, the taciturn Scot.
And what is this movie? Some people here watch movies, unlike your parents. But
yeah. unlike my mum and dad. It's what a guy came up the other night, last night. He said, "Don't you think it's a bit of an irony that you, you know?" I said, "Thanks for pointing that out." But yeah, it's a long, crazy story. But the movie's called Bobby Jones: Stroke of Genius. It's a dreadful movie. It stars Jim Caviezel playing the part of Bobby Jones. He had just played the part of Jesus in The Passion, and then he came to Atlanta to play Bobby Jones. And sorry, I shouldn't really say this, but my role was Stuart Maiden, and so I was the head pro at Eastlake when Bobby Jones was a little boy, and Bobby Jones learned to make a golf swing, not by taking lessons, but by emulating the golf swing of the pro that I played, which had an irony in itself. But, so people said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm actually down in Atlanta teaching Jesus how to play golf." That's terrible.
Yeah.
That's bad. Yeah. Sorry.
So, okay, then we'll move off of that. So, you've been in America. You're a citizen now, is that right?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, so you've been here longer than some of the people in this room, but yet there's nothing like coming from another country and another culture that gives you a fresh set of eyes. What surprised you about America, and what still surprises you about the church here, either good or bad?
Yeah. Well, you know, I had never met an American family until I was 16, and I met them in suburban London. I was invited to lunch at their home. They had four daughters, and I chose one of the daughters to be my wife, although she was only 13 at the time and didn't fully understand.
How old were you?
I was 16.
Okay.
And that family introduced me to Campus Crusade for Christ, and that had come to Britain in the 60s, and they thought it would be a good idea for me to go to these things called Institutes of Biblical Studies, and I went to one at the University of Aberystwyth. And it was there, in that context, that American Christians, vibrant folks, essentially taught me the importance of sharing my faith and of helping me how to do that and being bold in witness. And I found that enlivening, challenging, and thoroughly unlike the basic sort of clipped conservative English, Scottish context where you would have to prize information out of the person, even if it was good information. And so that was my first introduction to American Christians and American Christianity. And it remains for me to this day, you know, the fondest and happiest of recollections. And I feel a peculiar debt to that period in my life and to those people. And that then led in 72 to me going to Expo 72, which was a big Campus Crusade extravaganza held in the Cotton Bowl, I think it was, in Dallas. And I have just always been enamored by and encouraged by the openness and the vibrancy and the inventiveness and the can-do-itness of American Christianity. That, I think, would be the biggest thing. And in local church context, to come from a situation in Scotland where if you had, you know, a relatively decent idea, you could pretty well guarantee that it would be shot down in flames before you managed to fully articulate it. It would hit the waste paper basket, you know, under a deluge of fire hoses, saying, "We've never done it that way before, and I've heard some people have tried that, and it's no good," and so various things. Whereas here, I have to be careful on the other end, that the willingness to get behind a concept, an idea, and get it going. So I'd want to be there, first of all, in affirming those plus things. And the fact that America continues to make such a huge impact in the world and in the world of world missions, on account of the generosity. You know, if it is in giving, let us be generous. And I haven't found another nation in the world that's as generous as the American nation.
Well, those are all nice things.
Yeah.
That's great.
I've learned, I used to start with bad things, but I've learned to make sure I start with nice things.
So what are some blind spots see that we can't?
I don't think there's any that I can see anymore. I am actually enculturated now. I really think I am. I think I couldn't say I'm thoroughly Americanized, but because I'm on the side of things, when I go home to Britain, I'm constantly defending the circumstances that I've left behind. And I realize that I'm doing so because I actually believe these things. Well, you know, I have been just... one of the things that struck me when I arrived was this peculiar sort of political thing that emerges, I think, as I've watched it, out of an understandable, proper, and right desire for the well-being of the nation and for the impact of the Christian community in the halls of justice and in the execution of the political process. However, in watching this saga go general election after general election after general election, I've actually concluded that in some measure, among some folks, it emerges because of an aberrant kind of theology, that they do not understand what this kingdom is that Jesus Christ came to build, that they have not fully wrestled with the fulfillment of the purposes of God in putting together a company that no one can number from every tribe, people, language, and so on. And that the danger that Britain faced and fell into, especially in conservative Christian circles, America has just walked down the same path. When I was growing up as a boy, there was a thing in Britain called British Israelism, and it was actually a sort of phenomenon. But it went like this, you know, that the promises that attach to the children of Israel are really apropos Great Britain, because we have an empire, we rule the waves, rule Britannia, here we go. And so you had these biblical promises misappropriately applied to political entities, and then, of course, as the empire begins to unravel and disintegrate, then we got to cast around for another explanation, and only to discover that actually these promises had nothing to do with what Britain was doing in Rhodesia or in Zambia or in any other place. And so I'm kind of excited at the moment, because I think that there is a peculiar opportunity now for the Church of Jesus Christ to take seriously what it means not to be disengaged from the political process, but to be engaged in it in a way that is bringing to bear upon the circumstances the values of the kingdom. And a picture that we're prepared to recognize that certain things can be bad for the country and good for the church. And unless we're prepared to understand that distinction, then we'll probably be buried under a morass of things. And I'm disappointed to find how many Christians have become increasingly angry and sort of miserable and negative about so many things. And the idea of the joy of the Lord being your strength, of having a story to tell to the nations, of being able to say these things. I think we've lost a beat or two by aligning ourselves with certain agendas that have to this point been unfulfillable and probably will always be unfulfillable. Every empire in the world has the Ottoman Empire, any empire has come to an end. And America is able to do things faster than any other nation I've ever seen. So I wouldn't be surprised, you know, the bigger they come, the faster they fall. And I think Christians are going to have to face up to the fact that it may not be the way we expect it to be. And in actual fact, the election of the president this last time may have saved us from a real disaster, if you think about what the alternative might have been. Nobody really thinks that way. because the Christian right was so allied to, well, we got to take the best of whatever the bad job is. But I'm not so sure anybody fully understands what it would be like to have somebody who believes that Mormonism is not an absolute fabrication and the worst kind of lie and a dead, dark emptiness. To have somebody in that position sitting in the White House, we've no idea what that could possibly be. And so I'm just thoroughly confident, and I'm sure you are too, that God is sovereign in all these things. He knows exactly what he's doing, and his purpose is for his people in every shape and size. Therefore, he loves the Palestinian Christians just as much as he loves the Israeli Christians on the West Bank. And he's just as concerned for them as he is for the believing Christians in Jerusalem today. Unless we have an understanding of God's kingdom that is garnished by the scriptures, then we will almost inevitably go wrong on those things. And I think in many cases, we have done.
Good word. Talk about books. You love books. To read.
Yeah.
Okay, so transition here.
Don't ask me what's your favorite book right now.
Okay, won't ask you that.
Okay. I was going to say yours. You know.
Oh, yeah, as well.
Yeah.
I was going to ask what's your favorite book.
Yeah. Your newest one.
Yes. Who's one of your favorite dead theologians?
Oh, one of my favorite dead theologians. Well, Americans, B.B. Warfield. Gresham Machen.
Mm-hmm. Christianity and liberalism.
Yeah, I really found him helpful. Professor Murray, whom I've mentioned.
Three for three Presbyterians.
Yes, I know. Well, my roots go that way, see. You see, I'm the most Presbyterian guy that ever baptized an adult that you've ever seen. So, you guys have got a lot of it right. You just can't be right on everything. So,
I love to baptize adults too.
I know.
And their kids.
I know.
Beautiful.
I know. That's the other thing. You have to try and have it both ways. You just can't make up your mind. So,
Spurgeon.
Yeah, Spurgeon.
Just to give
you
a Baptist.
Yeah. Why don't you just read the list?
Yeah. I know. Do you read non-Christian writers?
Yes, I do. I do.
What sort of genre?
I like historical non-fiction. I've just become a big fan of a fellow who's only written four books that I've been able to find. His name is Eric Larson.
Oh, yeah?
And his most recent book, which I read first, is In the Garden of Beasts, and the rise, the person that America, that Roosevelt put in as the ambassador to Berlin during the rise of Hitler. And the fascinating thing about Larson is that he is able to create these books out of extensive research where he has found the transcribed material of conversations that have taken place between individuals. And then he is able to write those conversations into dialogue in a way that does no disservice to the actual historical development of the plot. One called, is it Death in the White City, mm-hmm. which is a story of the World Fair in Chicago, Isaac Storm on the development of weather forecasting and the storm that destroyed Galveston historically. It was a hard book for me to start because I don't really like people who weather forecasters much. Not that I know any of them personally, but they're always trying to make it sound worse or better than it is. The other one that he did was the story of Marconi and the development of the telegraph. I also read P.D. James, Murder Mysteries, mm-hmm. The lady who's still writing in her 80s. I'm pretty eclectic. I don't read rubbish. I don't read junk. But I'm reading all kinds of stuff, like contemporary philosophy in absorbable chunks, you know, not highbrow stuff, but like all things Shining, the book on trying to make sense, you know, the subtitle of it was something like trying to make sense of our world by reading the classics. You know, you've got a professor from Stanford and a professor from Harvard who are both really clever, and their best thing they can offer to the world is, if you're going to try and make sense of your world, you know, read Moby Dick. And, you know, for those of us who have tried to read Moby Dick, we thought, if that's going to make sense of the world, I don't have much to go on. So I'm trying to I'm trying to read in such a way that both is an enjoyable exercise for me and also creates a seedbed out of which I'm able then to interact with the culture.
Do you have current Christian authors or books that you'd commend to people?
Yeah, I just have to think about that for a moment. I mean, I don't want to do a be funny guy, but Kevin writes really, really well, as you know, and his stuff is always worthwhile, and so I do read Kevin's stuff, and the guys on my pastoral team do, and so if they're going to, then I have to, just so that I can see see what nonsense they're coming up with next. So I read. Well, I shouldn't say I read. I read the first three books that Tim did, Keller, to my great prophet, and gave them out. I've been helped by the stuff that John Dixon has done up until his present book, which I have not yet read, but I approach with severe caution. John is a good historian, and he's an excellent evangelist. And so for his those wee books that he did, If I Were God, I'd Remove All Pain, is a really helpful treatment of the question of suffering. Not because, as you know, he resolves everything and ties a bow around it, but he does a masterful apologetic job of saying, okay, let's see what Buddhism has to say about suffering, and then he explains. Let's see what pantheism says about suffering, and let's see what. And he just goes down and says, let's see what the Bible says about suffering, and then he says at the end, judge for yourself who you think has got the best angle on suffering here, even though we don't have all the answers. And I found that a really helpful book because it was easy to give to people rather than books that are trying to be far more definitive than they can actually be, you know.
All right, one more question, and then we'll open it up to questions. Two-part. Anything? So I'm 35.
Are you really?
I am.
Jeez.
I have much more gray hair than you.
35.
Aye. Phew. When you look back, what by God's grace can you say, by God's grace alone, I had that right when I was 35? Something right about life, marriage, ministry, and what would you look back and say, boy, the Lord was merciful to help me, even though I can see now I made a complete hash of that.
Mm. Mm. Well, I think...
Or go back to 25 if you had more mistakes.
No. I go back to this morning for the most reason. I think at 35... I was thoroughly convinced, probably about two things. If you want, I mean, one would be I was thoroughly convinced about the sufficiency of Scripture. Right, I couldn't answer every question, but I had no doubts that I had in this book all that God wanted me to have, with nothing extraneous and nothing missing. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I could with confidence proclaim the book. I was absolutely convinced, too, about the exclusivity of Jesus, that there's no way to dodge this one. Either Jesus is who he says he is, or he isn't. If he is, then he must be reckoned with. If he isn't, then let's go get a decent job. So I was really convinced on that. at 35, I don't think that I had fully got a hold of the distinction that Goldsworthy addressed and that I alluded to last night about pressing people about the benefits of the gospel or warning them about the dangers of its rejection and not actually telling them the gospel itself. In other words, the same problem that you get when you read Martin Lloyd-Jones, Ian Murray's biography, and somebody comes to Lloyd-Jones and tells him, I don't think you're preaching the gospel. And Lloyd-Jones is completely devastated by that, and he says, but you know, I'm preaching the new birth. And the guy says, yeah, I know you're preaching the necessity of regeneration, but I don't think you're preaching the gospel. And then Lloyd-Jones goes away, and he gets Smeaton on the Atonement. He gets two or three books. He goes in his bedroom, and he won't come out. And Murray tells how they have to go get his brother to get him out of his bedroom. His wife's worried about him. But eventually he comes out, and he says, I think I got that clear. It's taken me time to get that clear. I think I got it clear. And the other thing is the whole sort of redemptive historical plan of things. My background starts off as a I wouldn't say crazy dispensational perspective, but a largely, you know, chopped up in pieces thing. My Scofield Reference Bible is still on my shelf with the pages barely intact. My wife gave me that Bible when I was 15. She wasn't my wife then, so... No, I couldn't be 15, I must have been 17, so she'd be 14. She gave me that Bible, and I used it for a long time. I used it till I started studying theology. And only when I got rid of my Scofield Reference Bible, and then I couldn't find all the sections. And then I said, maybe they're not there. And then as soon as I said, maybe if they're not there, then something else has to be there. And then I said, well, what is there? And then I started off on that whole journey. And that, just getting the notion of the big picture of God's purpose from eternity to eternity, it was something that I didn't really have a grasp of, even at 35. And hopefully I have a much better handle on it today.
And just to clarify, the Goldsworthy and then the Lloyd-Jones.
Right.
Are you hitting that distinction that Lloyd-Jones makes in Preaching and Preachers, the difference between being an advocate and being a witness?
Right.
Where he talks about, so maybe that may be helpful for the people in ministry here to say a little bit about that, just flesh it out, because Lloyd-Jones is so good, and I think you're right that there is a lot of preaching where people are they're an advocate for the truth,
right?
But they're not what Lloyd-Jones would call a witness,
right? Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. It's so long since I read that particular section that I can't work through that. But what I remember Lloyd-Jones is pointing out is that the apostolic testimony, the way in which even straight out of the gate that Peter preaches in Acts 4, listen, folks, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested by God by miracles, and he basically lays down then the life, the death, the resurrection, the ascension, the prospect of the return of Jesus Christ, and the approach that he takes there is then the approach taken by Paul, where Paul goes from place to place, first into the synagogues, and in the synagogue, he argues, he reasons with them from the scriptures, showing them that the Messiah must suffer and die. And then he says, and this Jesus is that Messiah. So that he's saying, this is that. And he is affirming the historicity of who and what Jesus has done and has accomplished. And that This redemption that is now accomplished is to be applied by the Holy Spirit through the witness to the gospel in the preaching of the word responded to in the hearts of those whose eyes are open to its truthfulness. Is that enough on it? Or do you want to clarify it even more?
Well,
because you should feel free to.
Well, I just think it's what you said yesterday and now. It is helpful, and it's right along those same lines, whether you said distinction.
So summarize it properly.
I think you did. What Lloyd-Jones was saying, you know, there's some preaching that it's all true.
Right.
And it's saying true things, and here's the Bible, and Jesus did this, and he died for sinners, and people must be born again, and there's a heaven, and there's a hell, and this is what the Bible teaches, and it's all true.
Right.
Let's pray.
Right.
And you don't get to that moment where... The preacher cuts through with a laser, sort of grabs you by the
right.
scruff of your neck
right.
and says, and you, whether you're rich, poor, you got degrees, you don't,
right.
you need Jesus. And
right.
are you going to come to him
That's
today?
Right. That's right.
in that sort of preaching, I think sometimes conservative evangelicals feel it's too direct, too emotional, too something.
Yeah,
it's that personal, passionate pleading.
It is. It's receive the reconciliation that has been provided for you. You know, you must. I don't have a problem with that part of it. My problem is I got to make sure that I have laid down the groundwork before I get to that part of it. Right. You know, so for example, last Sunday, we were in Mark 16, the opening verses of Mark 16, which worked out perfectly because we've been doing Mark. But I said, well, let's take the 3 hours approach to these 8 verses. Let's consider the record as it is given to us. This is Mark's record of these events. Let's consider the relevance of this record to life today, and then let us recognize that there has to be a response to this. Mm-hmm. And in the response part, you know, I stood away from the pulpit and I, you know, used the old chair. You know, and I said, you know, you can believe in the intrinsic benefit of this chair to hold you without ever sitting on it. And some of you are just there. You are unconverted believers. You're orthodox in your understanding of the person and work of Jesus Christ, but your faith has not found a resting place in him. And if you do not believe, you will die in your sins. That's why it's so important. And you must know this. In Enfield, I was in England for a week, 3 weeks ago now, doing evangelistic talks. I had 16 talks to give between Tuesday morning and Sunday evening. And in a variety of contexts, you know, like a men's curry night in an Indian restaurant with, 60% of the people completely pagan and unchurched. The proprietors of the restaurant standing behind me, you know, half a dozen Hindus, you know, getting ready to bring out the curry. And say, go ahead, it's okay now, they're going now, you're going to preaching now. I am understanding, you know. And so I'm listening to this and saying, no, go ahead, I'll give you curry after. And so, and I've got to stand up there and go right at it in the middle of that. You know, like the guy says, okay, the Anglican vicar says, all right, brother, do tell the people, will you? You have 20 minutes. And so it's just like, good evening, Alistair is here with us. He's from America, you'll understand that. He's going to give us a little talk about Jesus. Okay, Alistair, go ahead. You know, and you got guys that have never been 35 years old like yourself. The guy sitting opposite me at the table before we started, 35 years old from Newcastle. I said, what's your religious background? He said, none. I said, okay, I understand, but where did you go to church? I never went to church. I've never been in a church in my entire life. What about your parents? Never took me to church. Never went to church. He's not unusual. The generation beneath age 25 in Britain is increasingly a secular generation. The Christians are vibrant, which was so exciting about this. Because what struck me was, just what you're saying, I went back in that environment and I suddenly realized, these fellows are doing it, we're talking about it. We are at the local fair day giving out bottles of water. Hey, we're from Parkside Church, would you like a bottle of water? Who cares? Who even cares? They might as well have, the pregnancy center next door, you know, saying, hey, we're from the pregnancy center, would you like a bottle of water? Or the Muslims. Hey, I'm the imam, would you like a bottle of water? These guys, they were on the streets of Enfield with Gospels of Luke. And the Gospel of Luke was in a little cover. And the cover said on it, everybody needs Jesus. Don't take our word for it, take his. And we were stopping people in the street and saying, excuse me, do you have a moment to hear about a bad man that went to heaven? I mean, in your face, straight at the thing. And I came home and I said, you know, we've gone off the boil here. We're so busy building bridges for people, you know, to make sure that we're not, you know, we're building the bridge. Yeah, you know, we're checking it out. That's what we're doing. Let's get to the point here. These are the facts. It's really unpalatable in a pluralistic environment, but the facts are we're stuck with this one. And I was actually really humbled and helped. And the young people, I was struck with how committed they were to, you know, taking this on, and the amount of abuse and disinterest in the street was significant. I mean, people were not going, oh, thank you for the Gospel of Luke, you know. It wasn't quite like that, you know.
We have a lot of bridges, and we're not asking anybody to go across.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, you know.
We have microphones, and we have time for some questions that would be relevant, not just to you and, you know, whether you should get married or but the person you want to fire from your church staff, but Alistair reserves the right to say, I don't know, or
that's right.
I'm not interested.
Yep. And I'm good at I don't know.
Hi, Alistair. I'm Mike from Grand Rapids. First, I'd like to just thank you for the years of your radio ministry that's meant so much to me in my life. It's just an honor to be in God's army with you.
Thank you.
My question is, what's your thoughts on the Western Church and their tendency to turn towards entertainment rather than worship?
Well, that's a pretty big category, you know, the Western Church. The underlying issue is man-centeredness or God-centeredness. Genuine worship is God-centered. Spurious worship is man-centered. When we start the thing off with man and his need rather than God and his glory, we've started off on the wrong foot to begin with. And so the underlying issue, if there is an issue in certain cases, is a theological issue. It is an understanding of the nature of God himself, what it means to be brought into a relationship with God, and what it actually means to worship God. My experience is varied as I travel. I'm getting a sense that in many cases that sort of perspective is losing steam. People are growing older, that we're at the beginnings of that kind of approach, and they themselves haven't found it peculiarly satisfying. They haven't found that many of the endeavors to make Jesus so incredibly accessible to everybody by kind of blunting the edge of his clear directives has actually produced much in the way of genuine and unexpected conversions. And so I'm kind of hopeful that there's a turnaround in the direction of beginning with God and his glory. It's not much of an answer to your question. I'm trying to be guarded in my answer as well, because I don't want to become the champion of if I took things to their logical conclusion where I come from in my own mind, with my basis in the Highlands of Scotland, in Calvinistic Scotland, then I would be the pastor of a psalm singing congregation that had no musical accompaniment at all and sang only the psalms. If I can do that with conviction, and I can't because I don't really believe that, but if I move one step away from that, then as soon as I've moved one step away from it, then I've opened the door to all kinds of possibilities and ways of engaging both the material that one uses in worship and the liturgy that one employs in worship and everything else. And I go certain places in California that would not necessarily be well received in the Outer Hebrides. But I'm struck by the vibrancy of these people's commitment to Jesus and to the gospel and what they're doing. And I might wish that the way in which they did certain things was different, but I've got no reason to doubt their motivation. And in these instances, I'm not referring to people who are trying to do the Johnny Carson show, which dates me, you know, and just kind of sneak the gospel in under cover of darkness. These are just people who worship in a way that is different from what might be most familiar and pleasing to me.
Good. Other questions?
Sorry, that was a long answer about nothing. Nope. It was a good question, a bad answer. Sorry.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
I have a question. First of all, I'd like to thank you for doing the revision of Charles Spurgeon book, yeah. Morning and Evening.
Yes.
I wake up every day, looking forward to that reading. My question to you is, what impact has that book or his ministry had on you?
Oh, that's good. Yeah, good. Well, thanks. You know, I think the Spurgeon Review was a tough thing in that it really needed to be done better than it was. But to do it more would be to remove almost Spurgeon from Spurgeon, and so I had to leave it at that. But I'm glad that it's helpful. It's helpful to me as well.
And this is Morning and Evening.
Morning and Evening, sorry.
Devotional.
Spurgeon's. You know, I told the guy at Crossway, I said, you know, I think I can do this. It won't be too difficult. It was a real labor of love, because there's 365 mornings and 365 evenings. And as soon as I started on it, I said, oh, man, this is going to take a long time. But Spurgeon's stuff is great. Some of them are just gems. Some of them are not, and I'm not sure I'm with him on Song of Solomon, yeah. and I cleaned up some of his references to the Roman Catholic Church, although I must say I agreed with the way he'd put it in the first place, but that's not for you to know. I think Spurgeon's lectures for his students is the thing. You know, I mean, that is, I even read it now. I dipped into it just last week looking for something. And, you know, Spurgeon, good old Spurgeon, you know the doggerel, don't you? There once was a preacher called Spurgeon who really detested liturgy. But his sermons are fine, and I use them as mine, and so do most of the clergy. And, so, yeah, Spurgeon is one of the dead guys who speaks. Yeah. He does. I find him profoundly helpful. He cuts to the chase very quickly, and he's God-centered. I like the fact that nobody can actually drive him into a corner in terms of eschatology, or even in terms of, you know, he is so good on the sovereignty of God and the responsibility of man. He's very, very, very good at that. And so, big influence. Feel free to chime in as well and clarify things.
Don't you also have I thought I heard you a little doggerel about John Stott, that the first time you always say, as John Stott says. Do you know where I'm going with this? And the second time I say, as a man once remarked, and the third time you say, as I've always said.
Yeah.
Maybe I got that from someone else.
Yeah.
I thought I heard
yeah,
you.
That's, no, I don't think that was me, but I like that. Actually, it's a little painful.
Well, you can't read John Stott's outline
on anything
until you've already come up with it. Because
right.
Once you see his outline, you think, well, that was inspired. And it has alliteration.
It's horrible. He's just what a guy. Nobody can thread the needle like Stott through a passage. No. And it's such a terrible thing, you know, that you... You know, as soon as you look at that, you go, what am I wasting my time for? You know, why don't I just go up and read the chapter? Yeah.
Other questions? Back there. Oh, John, we got up here first.
That was, that didn't go so
all right,
well.
And then you're next.
He's just going to the restroom.
Going back to the Christian's involvement in politics, we understand that that God's kingdom is not of this world, and yet, you know, we live in a republic in which Christians have an opportunity to be either involved in government or removed from politics and government. You know, so we have the option as individual Christians of, you know, just staying out of it and simply praying for those in authority over us, or we could run for office. So when you think about that, you know, situation that we face in this nation, the opportunities that we have, could you provide some, you know, both some encouragements and some cautions from that perspective of the Christian's relationship to politics and government in the age that we live in?
Sure. Well, I mean, succinctly, my encouragement to my people is to be entirely engaged in the political process at whatever level they have opportunity to do so. I mean, we are suffering we have suffered as a result of the kind of isolationist tendency that I alluded to last evening that has removed people from the journalistic world and given them the opportunity to be writing leading articles and so on in the press. And that is an unfortunate thing. I just saw something on my screen telling me about a Christian sitcom that is being launched in Britain. What in the world is a Christian sitcom? Well, you know, what do they do? Do they say the Lord's Prayer in the middle of it or something? I mean, what is a Christian sitcom? I don't understand these kind of things. What I want is the brightest and best girl in my congregation, the artist, the creative person, the genius, engaged in the world of the arts, living out their Christian life. And when asked about the nature of motivation and so on, answering that Jesus Christ means everything to them. Okay? There was just a piece yesterday, 2 days ago, Wall Street Journal, if you read the Wall Street Journal and you read the personal journal section of it, you know there's always in there, on a weekly basis, there's a little section in there called In My Bag, okay? And it's about either a guy or a girl who has like a briefcase or a travel bag, and they say, you know, what have you got in there? Say they got a BlackBerry, got an iPad and everything else. Well, the other day, the guy who was in there is a friend of my son's. His name is George Esquivel. And it was so nice just to see right in his bag, because they do a photograph of the bag, his Bible. His Bible's right in there. And they asked him, and he told them, he said, I have my Bible in here because I read my Bible. And if I'm late for an appointment, if I'm early for an appointment, I read my Bible. Okay, now, this is just a Christian guy in a secular world being asked a question because he's become the creative director for Tumi, the luggage company. Although he himself has a company of his own. But anyway, so when it comes to politics, I'm on the same thing. You can become the local mayor, become the local mayor. But don't come to me and ask me to turn my pulpit into a voting station to endorse the agenda of something that it is. So I make the distinction between the role that is played for me, which is to exhort and encourage my congregation to engage fully in the political process, in the world of the arts, in the world of medicine, to commend the businessman for being in the real world and living for Christ and being made for his pleasure, commending the school teacher in the public school for holding the line in relationship to Christian things, all of those elements, that's part of my problem, that's part of my privilege. I myself, then, I'm engaged in the political process. As a member of a democratic country where I can register my vote, which I do, and where I can be engaged in conversations. I just spoke for the Center for Arizona Public Policy a few weeks ago. The reason I took that opportunity, some people would be surprised by, was in order that I might encourage people who are engaged in the political process to make sure that they don't do so disengaged from the truth of God's kingdom and the Bible. So it's not an either or. And I would like to go back to Britain and become the Prime Minister of Great Britain. If someone says you can do that, we can set it up for you, do that, I'll go home. I'll do 30 years in Cleveland, I'm going back. Because that sucker has lost the plot over there as well. And the absence of leadership and the absence of a kind of Thatcherite gutsy approach to stuff is just dissipated. It's just washed out. Is that a fair distinction? Yep. I mean, his book on it has got the whole thing. What is the mission? Yeah. What is the mission?
Yeah.
Distinguishing between
what individual Christians are called to do and what the church as an institution is its mandate.
Yeah, and sometimes when I say the things about the church, people actually think I'm saying what you might think I'm saying, that is drop out, let it all go, we're doing the kingdom. I'm not saying that for a minute. Not for a moment.
Mm-mm. We have time for one more question. All right. Sir, oh, yeah. The last one.
You both spoke of presenting/preaching the truth of the gospel and then taking it to the next step of exhortation, where you actually get personal and exhort a response. And I believe you both used that word, a response. Can you comment on what that looks like? I know it's repentance and faith and internal confrontation with this, with the Spirit of God, but how does that play out in the physical public arena? What do you mean when you say response? What are you looking to if you're preaching the gospel and you're exhorting a response from the people? Can you comment on what that response would look like?
Well, at Parkside, it would probably look like this. When I've said what I've said, I would preface it in this way, and sometimes I preface it in this way and postlude it in this way. And say, you know, I've spoken very straightforwardly today about these things, and my hope and prayer is that some of you actually do want to get serious about what has been said. And if you do, there are a number of ways that you can. One is through the doors to your left and my right, there is a prayer room. And in that room, there are some folks that have both literature and a listening ear and a desire to respond to your response, if you would like to do that. If you would like to do this, if you would like to do that, if you would like to come to this, if you would like to go to that. Once in a blue moon and never on the strength of emotion, have I actually asked for a public response right there and then in the congregation. And I've done so, probably you could write it on, I could probably count on my one hand the number of times I've done that in 30 years. And always because I had a strange inclination in the weeks leading up to that there was kind of, that I had sown and led, and that there might just be a moment here for saying to people, let's just identify ourselves with whatever this is. But to make that a standard pattern for me, that is not something that I've ever chosen to do. And so the way it would look is just like that. We have folks outside. The key is that in your heart, I'll often lead in a prayer at the end of my time that would again be prefaced by something along the lines of, you know, this may be the end of a link, this may be the final link in a chain for you. Someone has told you this story, somebody gave you a book, and you've come along this morning, and for whatever reason that you can't really fully explain, the pieces in the jigsaw have formed up. And you're sitting there going, can somebody please help me to know what I should say or how I should say it? And I lead them in a prayer that would give them an opportunity to pray along with me, and then and ask them to come and let me know. Let me tell you one funny, interesting story. I was preaching somewhere not so long ago, and I said to this guy, he was looking after me, like Joshua was looking after me, and I just were killing time, and I said, how did you become a Christian? It was a long story, but eventually he's in a church service, and the minister lays it out, explains the gospel, urges upon people a response, prays, finishes, looks up, and says, if any of you out there responded in the way that I suggested, phone me up tomorrow morning. Here's my number. And he gave the telephone number. And this guy that I was sitting with, who was a businessman, whose wife had come to faith, and who had told her, you can have faith if you want, but I'm not having it. She pled with him, please come to church. Wow. He came to church. God used the word, nailed him between the eyes. He phones the guy up. Hello? Yeah. Hey, you said you should phone up if you were, you know, in on the deal or whatever you had going there or whatever your thing is. And the pastor said, he says, yeah. I said, well, you know, my name's Joe, and I did it. What am I supposed to do now? It's just like that. The pastor says to him, come by my study. I want to give you a Bible. When do you want me to come? Come whenever you want. Okay. He goes by the study, and the pastor gives him a Bible. And he gave him the Bible, and he says, listen, I expect you to come to church. I don't know if you will or not. Come back in a year and tell me if this thing is actually real. Just tell me in a year if it's real. And the guy told me, he says, every year on the 11th of January, I phone him up and I say, hey, pastor, it's real. Okay? Now, did his response bring about his transformation? No, the transformation of God brought about his response. And so I'm confident that all that the Father gives to Jesus will come to him. And he uses all kinds of mechanisms in different ways.
Amen. I don't have any have anything better to add than that.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.